Okay, before we get to the questions, I thought I'd say a few words about the Four Noble Truths. It's mainly because it is the core teaching of Buddhism. It's according to the text, the discourses, in the Theravada tradition, all Buddhas were supposed to teach the Four Noble Truths, right? And it's very essential to the understanding, realization of Nibbana, that you have to understand and you realize the Four Noble Truths. And what are these Four Noble Truths? It is that there is suffering. That's the first Noble Truth. You know, it sounds kind of pessimistic, but the Buddha started with that, but I'll explain it later. So the first is there is suffering. Second is the cause of suffering. Right, there is the cause, and that is craving. The third noble truth is that there is a cessation of suffering. Right, the suffering ends. And the fourth is that there is the path to realize the cessation of suffering. Right, so sometimes people who haven't studied very deeply the Buddha's teaching, the teachings of Buddhism, this is about Buddhists, very pessimistic. We go on and on about suffering, suffering, and suffering. But that's not true. The Buddha taught that there is suffering, but also the end of suffering, which means happiness, right? So it's a very practical teaching, something we can all apply to our life. And it's interesting why the Buddha would frame his teaching, because that's the first discourse of the Buddha. It was 3 months after he became enlightened, he taught the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta, and that's where he expounded the Four Noble Truths. And just reflecting, you were the Buddha, you just became enlightened, so extremely happy. He apparently sat under the Bodhi tree and stared at it for 7 days in utter bliss without moving. So, obviously, Nibbana is the highest happiness. And so, an extremely happy person, why focus on suffering? Interesting. Yeah. So, obviously, he can pitch the Dhamma, obviously, in any way he wished. And yet, he focused on just telling people that there is suffering. And maybe, and even after he became enlightened, he did say that, the Dhamma that he realized, obviously, he didn't invented the Dhamma. Dhamma is reality, it's truth. It's just something he saw into, the nature of reality, the laws of nature. And he said, he says that, this enlightenment is very difficult to realize. The Dhamma that he discovers is profound, subtle. That's very hard for humans, normal people, to understand the Dhamma that he discovered, because we're caught in sensual indulgence, we're caught in sensual enjoyment, and we're caught in doing and being. And the Dhamma that he discovered is actually, it goes in the opposite direction of peace. So maybe that's why he framed it in that way, that, obviously there is happiness in the world. There is happiness in the five sense world. That's, if there weren't any happiness, people wouldn't be doing it. Right? Wouldn't be chasing after good food, movies, relationships, achievements, fame, gain, loss, degrees, knowledge. There is some happiness. But if you look deeper, it is because these sort of happiness is unstable. It's not permanent, right? And it's outside of our control. And that's the reason it gives rise to suffering over and over again. Right? So there is, so with most of us, we have to admit that there is, some kind of stress in our life, because the happiness that we're after is impermanent, unstable. And that makes it, and the more we grasp onto it, the more stress, the more we suffer over it. Right? Happiness for most of us, it's always, it looks like it's within reach. Every time we get there, it's gone a few feet ahead of us. And the faster we run, the faster we chase after it, the further it runs. So something that, you know, we don't want to admit, but something we look deeply, we have to kind of go, oh yeah, the Buddha knew what he was talking about. So there is suffering, and the cause of suffering is craving. And there's different types of craving, he elaborated. This craving of sensual desires, the five sense world, that's hopefully it's fairly obvious. There's also craving to be. Craving to, you know, to be somebody, to be famous, be powerful, be noticed, to be anything, you know. That's very powerful. And also, when you don't get what you want, the craving for extinction, craving not to be, that's also a craving in people's mind. And these are the type of craving that leads to rebirth and that causes suffering. So by recognizing that, you know, we have this craving in the mind, we can also go to the third noble truth of the cessation of suffering, of letting go. And he taught four different ways to let go. First is chago, which is generosity, you know, doing things for other people, giving things away. That's, you know, that's the one way of letting go, of creating, you know, lessening the suffering. Second is patanisago, which is thrown away. So these are the different ways to let go. So throwing away our possessions, throwing away thoughts, ideas. Third is mutti, freedom, allowing things to go as well. And aliyo, which is non-roosting, what Ajahn Brahm calls the Teflon mind, the mind that doesn't hold on to the past, hold on to the, you know, kind of grasp for the future. Whatever anybody said to you, anything that's happened, just allow it to be. Allow it to be in the past. For most of us, we have a mind that's just the opposite. It's very sticky. Things happen, we turn it over and over again. We try to reflect on it. We try to find answers to it, which may have its uses, but a lot of time it's not. We're just stuck in the past and, you know, things happen. We have emotional dramas, and of course, so those leaves an imprint in the mind, and then obviously they affect us going future because the mind cannot let certain events go. So we suffer because of these by attachment, suffering because, you know, things stays in the mind and we don't have the tool to allow them to fade away on their own, right? And so those are the four different ways that we can practice letting go, right? You know, generosity, patanisago, throwing things away, freeing things, and attaching to things, not to have a sticky mind. And then there is and the fourth noble truth is where it brings it, just not theoretical teaching, but it's something for us to do. It's the path to the cessation of suffering. It's the Eightfold Path, right? Sometimes get technical, but yeah, there are eight things we should be cultivating. Eightfold Path, mostly, to summarize it, it starts with sila, moral conduct. First is right view. Right view for Buddhism is very important. You have to have the belief or the trust, the faith, that there is a law of karma, that whatever you do intentionally, if you do good things, then you can reap the good karmas. If you do things, unwholesome things, you hurt people, say mean things, have evil intentions, then those are going to come back to haunt you. It may not necessarily be this life, but be your next life. And then that's one, is you have to have a view that there is kind of a justice in the world, that these things don't go unnoticed, whether anybody noticed or not. You know, these things, there is a kind of imprint in the universe of our intention. And then the second is that there is this world and the other world, which is, this is hard for many kind of Western conditioned people to understand, to take, is that, you know, there is other realms of existence. There is, you know, there's rebirth, you know, that this is not the only life. That way it makes more sense when you think, you know, why are people born, babies are born sick, they haven't done anything to anybody, so why, they are suffering so much. Or why people seem like very kind of evil people, and they get away with, doing lots of harms to other people. But when you understand rebirth, and you realize that, sometimes we're born healthy, other times we're born, sickly. And it changes from lifetime to lifetime. And also the people that have done harm to many people this lifetime, they may appear that they can enjoy life. But those things, they have to come back, they have to pay back of that in future lives. So it makes us very careful to make sure that obviously we've been reborn many, many times. It makes us careful that we, always kind of try to incline our mind towards wholesome acts. That way we don't have to repay the debts of our, bad intentions, right? And that's part of the right view. I'm not saying that you have to believe everything, but you have to kind of say, oh, okay, faith in the Buddha is more like a roadmap, which means that, let's say you're born in the desert, and, then the roadmap, the map that you have describes, the sand dunes and the landscape in the desert, very, very clear, very, very precise. So you said, okay, the Buddha knew what he was talking about. In terms of, keeping the precept, if you practice meditation, you feel better, if you have good moral conduct, you feel, you're happier because you do things for other people, you practice generosity, you do things for other people, it makes you happy. So you say, okay, Buddhist teaching, as far as I can tell, seems to be working. And the more you practice, the more you realize the teaching. Right? So you have a lot of faith because what the part of the Dhamma that you realize seems to be spot on. The Buddha knew what he was talking about nature of our attachment and what sufferings it brings. And then, with just like the map, although since you were born in the desert, you haven't seen waterfall. You haven't seen water before. But then in this map, there's this waterfall. You say, oh, I wonder, what is that all about? You have no idea. But his description of the landscape around where you live is very precise. So that gives you a lot of faith that although you've never experienced, you've never seen what a waterfall may be like, it's not totally wrong. And it's the same with the further teachings of the Buddha, Buddhist teaching that you may not have experienced. Most of us don't remember our past lives. So it seems kind of, obviously it's something hard to accept. And especially, Western science so far, there's nothing to measure or nothing to verify that there is another life or different realms. So we're more inclined to say, well, it's kind of a cultural addition from Asia, or it's added on later by, some of the writers, a bit of fairy tale, hocus pocus stuff. But and we can, and it's a reasonable kind of position. But you can also remember that, this is to keep that in mind, that it is a possibility. You don't have to believe it all, but you can understand that there is a possibility that these things happen. And to look at science, you can see that, I was talking about like modern physics the other day. That on one level we are just sitting here, but another level is just molecules spinning around, lights. We're supposed to see colors, red and yellow, but we also know that it's just wavelengths, right? It's not really colors out there. It's just a bunch of wavelengths, smells. We smell food we like, not like, but also that's just a bunch of molecules, and our nose interpret that. So there are different levels of realities out there. And Buddhist teaching also kind of come under that. These things we don't understand is that, it's still there, but it's not something that we can see clearly. So that's why the right view is important, in the sense that if you have a view that there is many lifetimes, you've come, been here many times, then there's this kind of patience to our practice, that we can just, this lifetime, I'm going to practice as much as I can, We don't have to ask for the results right away, and then just create the conditions, the wholesome habits, to continue your practice throughout your life and perhaps the next life, right? And these are what the, you know, the Buddhist kind of the core teaching of the right view. And from that, we can start practicing a moral conduct, morality, and then once we kind of have a stable foundations of virtuous moral conduct, then we can move on to meditation. And from the stillness of meditation, you have the wisdom that arises from that. Right. So that's so that's the practice of Buddhism, is to cultivate moral conduct, practice to still the mind, and then to when the mind is strong, to see into the nature of reality, and to let go of the attachments that we have regarding our sense of self, to see through the what the Buddha calls non-self, to see that everything in the universe, in our mind, our body, is also impermanent. The whole universe itself is impermanent. It passes away, it changes all the time. And that because it changes, and it's because it's out of our control, and that's where the suffering comes in. Okay? So that's just a brief kind of talk on the Four Noble Truths. And it's something for us just to contemplate, especially the First Noble Truths, suffering. And to keep in mind some of the saying of some of the saints in the past. And in the words of the Buddha, it says, what the wise say is suffering, the ordinary worldling say that is happiness. And what the wise say is happiness, the ordinary people think is suffering. So just reflect, is this really happiness, what I'm doing? What I'm up to, sense pleasure, is that really happiness, is it suffering? And what is it, what does that mean? To suffer, what does it mean when you're happy? And just to kind of reflect on that after a good meditation. And the more the mind realize what is happiness and what is suffering, the more it will move away from, doing anything that would harm yourself or harm other people, and move towards peace naturally. It's not, enlightenment is not a kind of a force of the will, not an act of will. It's a natural process of the mind moving towards what it considers to be happiness, which is peace, stillness, and away from unwholesome habits, away from distractions, confusions, and negative thoughts of mind. And the more deeply these things kind of penetrate into our mind, the more happier we become. Okay, so that's a few words on the Four Noble Truths. Any questions or comments? I think when you are wishing like when you're not being harmed, safety makes them then beings feel happy when they're feeling safe and secure. So we wish people to be happy, but also when they're secure, when they're safe, then they feel a sense of ease. So that's why sometimes it's also translated. May all beings be at ease as well. And gladness, I think gladness is also the word for, it's just a different kind of, translation is never perfect, but I think I look at the Pali, Sukhino is actually happy. So, wishing people to be happy and to be safe. Like safe travels. Yeah. We can go to questions then. Yeah. Okay. Dear Ajahn, you talked about the fifth precept yesterday. Can intoxication be occurred when we do shopping or eating food too much? Wanting and confusion with selection, with metta. Yes, unless you're enlightened, there's always some confusion and intoxication with the five sense world. And that's why maybe we shouldn't add anymore, intoxication by taking things in our mind. And it's true. I mean, I think the Pali thing, we can be a bit legalistic, but the Pali means, you know, like, you know, fermented drinks, and because it leads to intoxication. But then some people might say, well, so does coffee or whatever, or tea or caffeinated product. Yes, these things, you know, can add to that. But basically, the rule is mainly about fermented drinks and or anything that confuses the mind. So, but it's true, if you are looking for your welfare, and so you would avoid things that would cloud your mind, cloud your, you know, mindfulness or the clarity, and stay away from, yeah, even caffeinated drinks if you think that that will, you know, make you act in ways that are not wholesome or might disturb your meditation and other kind of activities as well. They add to the confusion and distraction in the mind. Yeah. But it's not strictly breaking the precept if you overdose on caffeine or anything. Yeah. Any questions or comments? Dear Arjun, how can one subdue or undermine the sense of self? Thanks. Just like I said, different reflections, not me, not mine. And you have to see that, you know, really reflect on what is this sense of self? Where is my self in this? You know, take the body. Is it really your body? Do you have full control over it? Can you say, I want to grow 2 inches taller? Is that going to do it? It's not going to happen. You're going bald. Can my hair not fall out? Not turn gray? No, it's not going to happen either. So where is that body of yours? When you're sick and you say, I want to feel better today. I want to feel more energetic. Is that going to happen? No. So it's not your body in that sense. You don't have full control over it. And that's the most easy thing to say. But the mind changes even quicker. Can I always feel happy? I want to feel happy all the time. Is that going to happen? No. So that's why, how can it be yourself? Where's yourself? If yourself are your thoughts, well, these thoughts disappear. Where's that? You know, your memories, they come and they go. When you get older and you have, you know, Alzheimer's disease, where's yourself then? It's all disappeared. You can't remember anything. Right? So the Buddha pointed out very clearly that if you look at, dissect the, this body and mind complex that we inhabit, every time we ask, is a self. Yeah, okay, there's something here, obviously. I'm sitting here and I'm not sitting there with you. And you're not me. It's true, there is some entity, something there. But it's not a self. It's not eternal. It doesn't last forever. And it doesn't come under our control. So that's why it's not a true self. Because we can't control it. Right? It doesn't come under our wishes, our will. So we kind of, you know, work with it. But it's not a self in that way. And we take, you know, like, yeah, the two main things, your thoughts, your memories, your intention, they change very quickly. We can, you know, have some control over it, can direct it, but it's not a 100% sure. So that's the reason why once we keep reflecting that, then it does undermine slowly our sense of self. Right? Does that make sense? Questions or comments? But not to say there's nothing here, there is something here. There's a body and mind process that we're undergoing. Yeah. And it's true, only when you become enlightened that you can penetrate through the sense of non-self. So there is always, we'd always feel there is a self. You know, we feel that there's a self, and once you feel that, then most of the teacher kind of teach that you, as long as you feel that there's a sense of self, you should incline your mind towards, you know, cultivating wholesome habits. You know, doing the right thing. Instead of saying, oh, there's no self anyway, so I do whatever I want. I can hurt people, steal, take things. It's not me anyway. Well, there's still the law of karma for you to kind of pay. Okay, this is the fan letter for somebody out there. Congratulations to the couple keeping the 8 precepts. What an inspiration. So there you go. I think during the retreats, right? Or maybe their whole relationship. But anyway.
is focusing on qualities such as peace, chastity, honesty, and kindness, too self-centered. I let the idea within my personality arise and fade away. Well, like I said, we have a sense of self. We might as well try to cultivate the wholesome self in ourselves rather than kind of, you know, doing things that would harm ourselves and others. And then once you have a solid foundation of moral conduct, and you practice meditation, and you see that's actually when you're in the stillness of the mind that your thoughts come and go. You don't generate them. They don't come from within you. And you also see, you observe quickly, how the body also changes over the years. You see, wrinkles appearing on your face that weren't there 5-10 years ago. Your body starts to change on its own through the aging process, right? So and your habits also change over time. So we start to reflect, where is, this self? So, focusing on qualities such as peace, chastity, honesty, and kindness, that's actually, you're letting a lot of yourself go, actually, so it's not really self-centered in that way, right? If you're making peace, then even when you feel like you want to have an argument, you say, okay, I'm not going to act on that. So you're letting go your desires, letting go of the coarse desires. So like I said, with the self, we are by nature, because of an enlightened mind, self-centered to a certain degree. But that is also a cause of suffering, because there is, the more we focus on the self, the more we depressed we get. I mean, look at the whole world. We have this age of me and myself. Every advertisement, indulge in yourself, do whatever you feel like doing. And where has that gotten us? People who indulge in themselves, you usually end up very depressed, because they can't see there's the whole bright, beautiful world outside of their wants, the deficiencies, the desires, their sickness, or whatever, the body. Once we focus outside, and that's why you see that people who, notice in the Catholic Church, people who do charity work, very, very happy, because they're worrying about other people, doing things for other people, and there's a brightness to it, lots of energy, because you're not worried about, what you want or your energy level, but you're working for the welfare of the community. So you can see that as well. In people around us. People who are selfless actually are quite happy. And people that from your own personal life are always very concerned about, what they get out of life and how they can benefit themselves, end up very lonely and depressed actually. So that's something we can also learn from people and situations around us, actually. Any questions or comments? Does it make sense? Dear Ajahn, please let venerable monks to explain why they have selected Ajahn Brahm's monastery and how they have been here, including you, with metta. I'll go first. Okay. I ordained in Thailand, as most of you know, and trained there for 2 years. But during that time, there was a few Dhamma talks of Ajahn Brahm in the library, and I listened to that, and I was quite, obviously very inspired by Ajahn Brahm's teaching, very clear, and from a Western perspective that I can relate to. And but at that time, the monastery was quite full, and they said I couldn't go yet, being a very young monk. But then luckily, I think after the rains retreat, there was 3 or 4 monks. They had 5 rains retreat in the monastery already, so it was their time to do some traveling around to see other monastery, and then there was room. So I asked to come for 1 year, and 1 year turned out to be 8, and so I haven't left since, Australia anyway. I moved to Wat Buddhadhamma after that, but it's just there was room and different things came up or whatever, so he was kind enough to offer me a permanent place. So I kept staying. So that's why I'm in Australia. But we'll move on to the other venerables.
I'm a Perth boy, so I guess that's the reason why I'm practicing here under Ajahn Brahm, because there's a monastery close to home. Oh, there are other monasteries, but I wasn't really looking for a specific teacher. I just wanted to go to a place to practice, and Bodhinyana offered a place for me to practice. So when I first entered the monastery, I just wanted to go to a place where I can go and sit meditation to calm my mind down. So I was lucky enough to find a place in Perth. And I didn't really know about Ajahn Brahm before I went into the monastery. And then I went there and I listened to a few of his talks, and I understand the way he ran the monastery. So I liked the way he did it. I like his easygoing style, the amount of freedom that he gives us to do whatever we want. So yeah, it's a good place to be. As you all know, this is why you guys are here, I guess, because of Ajahn Brahm.
Okay, basically I was born in Malaysia, and I moved from Malaysia to Christmas Island when I was roughly about 7. And from there, I spent most of my life there. As I got older, I look at all my friends and what their behavior. Then I start to wonder, okay, I didn't like what they're doing. It's like, it becomes like too much of a gain, always trying to get something out of someone, something out of life. And there's no like moral discipline, like caring for one another, looking after one another. And always, instead of always trying to get something out of someone. So I saw life, a lot of problems. So when I read the Four Noble Truths, I realized, oh, okay, because of the desire, it's causing that problem. Okay, I have to work out how to cause more happiness to myself and also to help other people. So one thing I took is I took the Bodhisattva vow to help all beings. It sounded impossible, and I knew it was impossible, but it was good enough. So I will start from that first, and just to help other people, and also to cultivate the pure mind. So by doing that, I feel happier in my heart. Then like I put a lot of effort on mindfulness practice. When I wake up, always be happier, always willing to help people, always willing to do things to make people happier. Also to make myself happier. So that way, a lot of my depression left, and I feel happy every moment. And one of the members asked me, Kim, do you want to learn meditation? I said, okay. Yeah, I'm happy. I'm willing to learn anything. Anything goes. So he gave me a set of tapes by Ajahn Brahm on just simple, like washing your breath, making your mind calm and peaceful. So when I first started doing meditation, my mind went very calm and very peaceful. I felt so happy that when I came out, I almost cried. And from that point onwards, I did meditation almost every day. And the more I practiced, the more happy I became. And I just felt very happy. And I decided, okay, when I come down to Perth, I'll visit Bodhinyana Monastery. And ask advice from Ajahn Brahm on my practice. So when I came down, asked advice from Ajahn, he told me, okay, as you get deeper, things will happen. So as they arise, it's just a natural course of the mind, cause and effect. So But the biggest problem I realized, the more I learn, the more I understand, it became craving. Because of craving and wanting, it basically wrecked my meditation. My meditation went downhill for 5 years because of craving and desire to get the result. So it got to a point where I decided, I just give up. I can't be bothered anymore. I just go back to the beginning where I just want to be happy every moment and watch the breath, make my mind calm and peaceful. Then after that, the result came. Then I realized it came because of letting go and being happy in every moment. So as I got my meditation back, so I decided, I took redundancy and went back to Perth, stay with my family. But I always lost that calm of peace while I was working the mind and coming to Bodhiyana Monastery to stay. So I decided, I asked my parents if I can ordain, and they told me, no, you can't ordain because you owe us. And I go, okay. So I asked my parents, when can I ordain? They say, probably never. Not if they're alive. I say, okay, bum. I can't wait for another 10 years. It's just take too long. So I'm looking for the internet. Then I realize there are other people. There's one person, there's only son. He ordained. There's another person. He have to wait until his parents pass away. And he ordained when he was 50. Then I decided, wow, these people are way worse off than me. But they put the effort to ordain. And I got one older brother, and one younger brother, and one sister. I said, that's it. I got determined to come to the monastery and give it a go. So I came. I said, I'll give myself a go for 1 year. Stay for 1 year. I was very happy in the monastery. No matter how hard it was, I was determined to be happy, no matter what happened. And after 1 year, I decided, I'm very happy. So I'll give it a go for a few years and see what happened. But so far, it's so good. Yeah. But I'm not the smartest person, but I have a lot of faith. And faith is what's driving me forward in my practice. So basically, just my that's how I come across this monastery. So I'm very happy to be a part of this community and share my story with everyone. Because I feel everyone here is a big Dharma family, and we're all practicing something very wholesome in this world. So it's very rare. So thanks for asking that question. I'm very happy. Thanks. I asked a few times. I asked when I was 23 to say no. So I waited until I was 33, 10 years again. I asked again to say no. Then I asked when. Another 10 years to say no. I said, okay. So when? They say, until they pass away. I go, whoa, what about if I pass away first? So I realized, no, this is something I must do. Because lay life is good, but you tend to get caught up with the world, and you get a headache that builds out in the mind. It's only when you come to the monastery, then when you stay in the monastery, in the forest, then your mind calms down, then you feel very happy inside. And there's something you cannot get in the world. It's only when you stay in the monastery or come to the jhana grove. My mom say, oh, okay, so if you want, yes, you can give it a go. So my mom wasn't fully supportive, but coming to the monastery and seeing how happy I am, so as long as I'm happier and peaceful, she's happier. As long as I'm not miserable and and crying. My mom come out, I see me crying. Then my mom say, "Oh, go back." So I try my best to be happy. Yeah? My mom come over. So it's been very good at the moment. Yes. So yes, my mom gave permission to me. Yeah? I guess because I always look after my mom, but my mom will ask me to take her out shopping. I always take her out. So she got very attached to me. Since I was a child, I was always a very happy child. So I think my mom was sad to see me leave. But as long as she see me happy in the monastery, then she's happy too. Okay, thank you.
Story from, was it Chanda? Okay. Ajahn, did the Buddha teach to focus on getting jhana, or is it more of an incidental to good practice? He did. The many suttas he talked about, making the mind peaceful and then using that peace to reflect on the nature of reality. So, in a sense, he did talk about it. Focus on getting jhana. I think jhana is, or stillness of mind, is part of the process. So you're practicing correctly, it happens by naturally as well. So it is, something to aspire to, but it's also something that naturally happens when your practice deepens as well. Yeah. Any questions or comments? Yes? That's right, an eightfold path. Sama samadhi does mean jhanas. The Buddha talked about the fourth jhanas over and over again. So it's not something that was added later on. Buddha himself talking during his time. Yeah.
So what is the concentration in jhana?
What is concentration? Samadhi is, I think jhana, jayati, I'm not a Pali scholar, but I remember my Pali classes. Jayati, the word for to meditate, means to get into jhanas. But I think in the terms of samadhi, it's more of a general mean of kind of a stillness, a concentrated mind means more stillness. But yeah, it can be technical, and some of the technical aspect of it is referring directly to jhanas. Yeah, yeah. I think I can only speak from the Thai forest tradition, and they don't talk specifically about jhana because I think a lot of the Thais are not... brought up in a Sutta-based kind of context, but a more experiential. So they divide it, they categorize the experience of stillness to, like they said, momentary stillness, when the mind just becomes still for a few moments, and then they call it, access concentration, where the mind becomes still, but not absolutely still, and then when the mind becomes really, really still, and then they stop there. So they don't go on. So that could be taking when the mind becomes still, solid. It's like anything second jhanas and above. But like I said, Ajahn Chah was very emphatic on this point, that when you're meditating, there's no signpost saying you're in the first, second, third jhana. It's only after when you get out, you reflect on it, right? And it doesn't really matter whether you can label your experience as, first, second, third, or whatever. It's just... heading towards more contentment, deeper contentment, and deeper peace. And whatever labor that comes afterward is really incidental. But they do talk about stilling the mind first before you start to work on the insight practice. Or more like insight is something that happens after stillness of the mind. Yeah? So they do talk about byway, but they don't have a hugely kind of sutta-based kind of education. So it's more of a loosely based on experience. Yeah, questions or comments?
Sorry, so samadhi, is it corresponding to one particular jhana?
No, samadhi is a general term for just stillness.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yes? The Eightfold Path, yeah, for those who are interested in, I realize that there's a few people who are kind of not new to Buddhism, so they don't want to get technical, but the Eightfold Path, it starts out with right view, right intention, right speech, right action,
right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and then right concentration. Right. And yeah, each of those right can take up a whole hour of talk. Yeah. Yeah. So, but there's lots of books around. You can just get to kind of look it up. Yeah. Okay. Achan, we have two questions side by side here. Achan, can we do the chanting in Pali again? It sounds so much nicer compared to the English, if possible, thank you. And then we have the next question. Achan, it's so nice to have chanting in English. It's understandable to all. So, like I said, we'll do in English in the evening, and those Pali devotees can wake up at 6 and we'll do chanting in Pali in the morning. Okay? Here you go. Dear Ajahn, I'm relatively new to meditation, and the longest I sat was 1 hour continuously without moving. My legs were hurting badly. What do you think of the idea of taking some pain relief medication before I sit so I can sit longer with metta? Come on. You weren't listening. It's not the length of sitting that counts. It's the quality of your sitting. And you're sitting in pain, then, you know, you might as well, you know, get up and do something else. And so, as I said, when you're new to meditation especially, it's always to make sure that the body's comfortable. So please, sit on a chair. That way the mind will become still or starts to slow down. If you're in pain, you're not going to want to meditate for very long, you know, in terms of month or year. Because every time you sit, there's pain. So after a while, the mind will find excuses not to sit. Yeah, so there's no need to take the medication. It takes the Dhamma medication of kind of wisdom. Apply it. Okay, I'm going to make my body comfortable first. I'm just going to sit for 15 minutes or 30 minutes first. And just to kind of allow the mind just to kind of, you know, slow down, become still by itself. Right? It's not a marathon. It's not a sitting contest to see who's the last to leave the room, who's left sitting. It's here to train our own heart and mind, right? And you have a good 15 minutes. It's worth heaps more than sitting here 4 hours in excruciating pain every single minute. I mean, once you get a bit further down the track in terms of meditation, then pain can be a great teacher, and it brings up lots of mindfulness. But only when you have the spaciousness of mind to work with it, to investigate and to kind of look at it objectively. But until then, yeah, no need to endure the pain. Just make the body as comfortable as you can. And yeah, so if you have to take a medication, just sit. Not so long. Yeah. Questions or comments? Yeah, it's about the stillness of the mind, not so much about the stillness of the body. Yeah. So you can move. Okay, I emphasize, you don't have to sit without moving. You can move your legs and your knees or whatever when it's painful. Yeah. It's wisdom power that's going to liberate you, not willpower. Wisdom power is much more powerful, much more fun. Willpower can be looking for lots of suffering. Okay. Dear Venerable, I was thinking about the question which was asked a few nights ago, i.e., is Nibbana cosmic suicide? And why we might be afraid of Nibbana. The conclusion I came to was that the reason we might think Nibbana is something undesirable is because we think the five aggregates are ourself, and that the five aggregates are something desirable. We think that the five aggregates are self and that they are desirable. We will naturally crave for their continued existence, which goes in the opposite direction of Nibbana. So perhaps we should first aim to see through the illusion of self, that any fears we might have about Nibbana being the destruction of a self should fade away. Would you agree with the ramblings of this Patuchana? With this worldling, she says. Thanks, with metta. Yes,
basically, you know, the five khandhas are what the Buddha divide up the human body-mind process. First, you know, the first aggregate is the body, which everything, you know, is a body. Next is, what is it? Feeling. Pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling. That's also another aggregate. And then the third one is perception, how we perceive things. That's also, you know, like dislike. It's also another. The Buddha interestingly divided. Basically, it's a body and mind complex. But only one part of it is the body. The rest of the four division that he put in is the mind. So in Buddhism, that's why mind is so important, so central to the teaching. It's you know, Buddha put a lot of emphasis on the training of the mind, on analyzing different components of the mind. And yeah, and basically these things that we call body and mind rises, persist, and fade away. Right? And it's true. And so it's not a self in that way. You know, these things come together because of its conditions, and they will, you know, break apart when conditions are no longer there. And also, that's why some people said, well, you teach kind of nibbana is extinction, then it's kind of a destroying of self. But the Buddha was emphatic. He said, you know, because there is no self to begin with, that's why you're not destroying the self. That's why you didn't, you know, you don't, the arhants don't die. They're parinibbana. Things just come apart because they come together and now they're coming apart. That's all there is to it. Without craving, you know, your mental and physical process comes apart. But yeah, basically, it's true. There is not a destruction of self because there's no self to begin with. Dear Ajahn, is it full moon tonight? And can we have an all-night sit? Thank you. Close. It's not tonight. It's tomorrow night. That's where the monks have their traditional kind of ceremony that we do. We do a confession every fortnight with each other, and then we hear the recitation of the rules in Pali over at Bodhinyana. Unfortunately, we'll be here because there's a talk. We have to give the evening talks here. I was thinking about that because in Wat Buddhadhamma, we do have a kind of a late night vigil, a late night meditation session on full moon and new moon nights. And we do sit between 9 to 12. So Saturday being the last night, and it's a full moon, so all the conditions are right for us to strive. So I do encourage people to kind of, you know, play with your limits, sit for as long as you can, and then, you know, to see what happens. The full moon is a special night, actually. And because tomorrow, and Sunday night, I mean Sunday afternoon, you know, the retreat is over anyway, so it's the last chance to kind of have a good sit. So I do invite people tomorrow, after the evening meetings, to continue sitting to midnight anyway, and see. I mean, it's a beautiful moon out there. You can sit or walk, do walking meditation on the grounds. It's very peaceful. So yes, tomorrow we'll do our late night sit from 9 to 12. Yeah. Given that I'm struggling to remember much of what's been said during Q&A, which I've enjoyed immensely, I think I've turned the wrong dial and disconnected my brain instead of my mind. Okay, I'm wondering if we're able to purchase a copy of the recording from this retreat, and how can we do this? Oh, I think Dania and Mike, who are the caretaker, they're usually in charge of the recording. Yes? Oh, okay. Maybe Bianca knows something about it. Okay, yes. So they're available at the end of the retreats for $10. And see Mike or Dania, I think, at the end of the retreat. Yeah, okay. Dear Ajahn, why is the Buddha enclosed in a pagoda? He looks like he's in jail. Thanks. Yes, these are kind of different iconography. People kind of choose to display, you know, kind of show the Buddha in different ways. Yeah, I think pagodas or, you know, mounds are a traditional kind of Indian custom where you have a king or a very, you know, holy person passed away, and they make kind of a shrine out of it for them, and they bury it, they make big mounds, and it's kind of a memorial to beings. You know, when people see that, they realize, you know, that there is a very holy person there. It brings to mind that these things are, you know, the arahants, the enlightened beings are still around, and usually you have a lot of faith, brings a lot of, you know, happiness and inspiration to have these kind of stupas. And that's why the practice has evolved over the ages to have these little stupas around different places. And yeah, I don't know, sticking the Buddha statue in there, I guess, seems like a good idea to enclose it in something. And also, I think usually images of the Buddha, it brings, if you have a lot of faith, brings up a lot of happiness and inspirations. So that's why they're also put inside the stupas. Yeah. So it's more of a reminder, you know, an object of reverence for people. Yeah. Questions or comments? Okay. Dear Ajahn, when I notice my mind has wandered away from the meditation object, it is quite easy for me to redirect my focus. Does this mean I am suppressing the original thought? If so, what is a better way to approach a wandering mind? Now, with a wandering mind, is two things, and you kind of have to work out for yourself, to whether to kind of nudge it back to the meditation object, and if you can do that easily and the mind stays with your meditation object, say the breath or the body, then it's fine. And you continue doing that. But for some reason, sometimes these wandering thoughts are, disturbing. You redirect it to your breath, and then a few seconds later, you're off again. And if it happens, you know, two or three times, very close to each other, then you probably think, well, my mind is not quite ready to settle down onto a meditation object yet. So then it's time to just to watch it. It's okay. Mind, you want to run around? Okay, we'll just watch you for a few minutes. Just see where you want to run to, where you want to distract yourself with. And just to watch that. And I think a lot of us, because if we grab the mind too hard, it's going to, there's an energy, and it's going to kind of rebel. But just to be with it, allow it to go where it wants to go, then eventually it's kind of settled down, right? Similarly, Ajahn Brahm talks about a lot is this kind of what is called that the buffalo. I don't know apparently the stories goes that in the village where Wat Pananichat, the old monastery, is at, there's this villager, and they've got lots of buffalo. So every morning they take the buffalo out to the field to have a feed or to work, but sometimes the buffalo gets scared and he starts to run. Right, and usually the villager, he winds his rope around his finger or something. And this villager wasn't very clever. The buffaloes got scared, spooked for some reason. Maybe a car was driving by, and it starts to run. The villager, not wanting to let the buffalo go, starts to pull. And he didn't let go of the rope. So the buffalo kept running faster, and he pulled half his finger off. And he says, see, that's not a very wise farmer. Wise farmer would have just let the rope go. And he knows that the buffalo only runs so far. And then he stops eventually when he's feeling safe again. He's not so scared, he stops. And he knows where the food is, so he generally goes back to the house. And that's how you catch your buffalo mind. Same with the similes, that's how you catch your buffalo mind. When your mind is like a buffalo, it wants to run off, allow it to go. And then when it's kind of exhausted itself, it will settle down slowly. No need to force it. When you force it, you might get your finger ripped off. And same, becomes some stress or something. When you force the mind too much, you get ulcers in your mouth or tensions in your shoulders or your stomach. You start gritting your teeth. And so those are different symptoms of trying to force the mind too much. So meditation is a lot of time using wisdom to deal with our mind. Gentleness, kind of using your innate intelligence to figure out, what's happening here? Why is not the mind want to settle down? So use that wisdom. It's much more powerful than, like I said, willpower. Yeah. Questions or comments?
Last one. I'm interested to know about the timing of retreat, 3-9 days. Is there a specific reason for the allocated time, or is it just how it is? Thank you. I think generally, as far as I know, weekend retreats are quite convenient. People show up on a Friday night, leave on Sunday. You know, no dramas. You don't have to ask for a leave. And it's short enough where you kind of get a taste of meditation, learn to kind of refocus. So that's the reason for weekend retreats. Long weekend retreats falls into that same category. There's a 3-day weekend, and people also want to take that. And you know, obviously to kind of get a taste of meditation, or if you're a seasoned meditator, just to kind of touch base again. A nice break from your busy life. 9 days. I don't know.
Just take 1 week off work.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, that's what it is. There you go. It starts on a Friday and ends on a Sunday still. Yeah, and it's actually, yeah, you only take 5 days and you have the whole 9 days because you it's a bookend with 2 weekends. So that's the reason why they're popular, the 9 days, because you have the 2 weekends and then the whole week off. Yeah. But I think, yeah, and for longer retreats, there's, you know, you can have 30 days. The Tibetans do a 3-year, 3 months, and 3 days retreat. So those of you who are serious about meditation, you can try for those. You're not enlightened, ask for your money back. Yes? No, I think we were big on Easter retreat because people can string a few holidays together, and it's time, you know, people get off. So we're big on Easter retreat, and I think Thanksgiving retreats we like to do for some reason. But it's basically just a week off and then 2 weekends. Yeah. Excuse me? Yeah, good question. I don't know why it's on Thanksgiving. It's not Thanksgiving. It's just November retreats we call it, I guess. Yeah, okay. So it's not really Thanksgiving. I just associate with Thanksgiving, but it's just November. And yeah, that's the reason for there's no retreats between July and October, because Ajahn Brahm is doing his rains retreat over there. And during the rains retreat, which is 3 months, we generally focus on most our own personal practice of meditation, and so the rule says that we're not really allowed to leave the monastery, spend it, you know, like an overnight somewhere else. We can go out, teach, and come back, but we can't spend an overnight outside of the monastery during the rains retreat, unless it's a very good reason. You can take the 7 days leave when, like, you know, your parents are dying or something, but otherwise you're expected to stay in the monastery. So that's why there's no teaching during the rains retreat for that reason. Yeah. But also, it's a very nice time to spend at Bodhinyana Monastery or Dhammasara, especially Bodhinyana, because that's the only time where you can really count on Ajahn Brahm being around. The other times, he's like, you know, between Singapore and Europe or somewhere. But in the rains retreat, because of this rule, he has to be there most of the time. No, I think over there, there's room for 3 ladies. We have the guest monk here, and 4 lay men. Yeah, 4 men and 3 ladies, and 3 months long. He gives talks, but it's only once a week. Once a week, but also one nice thing is every 2 weeks, every fortnight, you have a personal interview with Ajahn Brahm just to check in regarding your practice. About 10 or 20 minutes interview or something like that. 15 minutes interview. 15 minutes interview. Yes. Yes?
Is it silence?
Who?
Are you in silence during 3 months?
No, we're very talkative. Nothing to do. But it's more restrained. We don't have coffee clubs. The coffee club is canceled. And we don't come out to evening drinks. You're meant to have drinks in your hut. So it's more restrained in that way. And there's not so much work project as well. So it's a very nice time to be in the monastery. Yeah, you get to really, well, you know, when the monks is actually meditating, and the monks are meditating and not doing so much. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry?
Mary?
This is a question for any or all of you.
Yes, I met a few in Thailand when I was there as a novice. And so there's a few monks. And that's the thing, well, you never know for sure, obviously. But they do have, you know, reputation of being very peaceful finish the work. And it's not something, obviously, you people, you know, talk about. But it, between monks, you can tell other monks about your realization of the truth. And these are the, and also you get it from, you know, obviously, it's kind of the grapevines kind of news. And you get it from monks who live with these, you know, really, these masters for many, many years. And they said, you know, I've never seen my teacher get mad. He always acts very kind. And you know, and it's very even all the time. Yeah, so you do have, you know, you lend credence to that. Okay, yeah, maybe there's some more to that. And then, and the only way to know for sure, obviously, is to live with these masters for a long time and see them for yourself. Otherwise, yeah, it's just, you know, people do have lots of projection. So you talk to different people, and yeah, all their teachers are enlightened or whatever, you know. And it's natural to think, you know, that your teachers are enlightened. Yeah, but I do have, I feel I had the good fortune to meet many monks who are obviously very, very peaceful and very, very kind. Yeah, so there's no reason to disbelieve. But there are obviously a few sensational cases where monks who have believed and then there's a scandal regarding a woman or something. And then so, yeah, those things also happen as well. So with anything, you know, faith is good, but, you know, reason faith, faith grounded in reality is much better than blind faith, right? So always, you know, any monks or nuns who kind of ask you, encourage you to break the precepts, then really think twice. If they're not living the life in restraint, they're using luxurious gut, then also, you know, obviously think twice. Yeah. I'll pass it on to Santuti.
In my life as a monk, I haven't really travelled around, so I haven't seen a lot of monks, which means I haven't met many enlightened beings, but I've heard stories about them, particularly in Thailand and in a few monks. And I remember there's this story. It's about this a monastery in Bangladesh, and I don't know about this monk, but it sounds like this monk is a pretty special monk. And during the Katina ceremony, which we have here in Perth, in the Katina ceremony that we have here, we usually get about 1,000 people turning up. And I don't know about in Thailand. How many people do they usually get in Thailand, say, for like Ajahn Anan or Ajahn? A couple of thousand. But in Bangladesh, there was this a forest monastery, and the amount of people that showed up was 50,000. So that, you know, that probably tells you that that monk there is a special monk. And they did things in the traditional way. There's one thing that we do for the Katina ceremony, and that is to sew the monk's robes. And what we do here is we get somebody from Nolamara to offer us about 2 or 3 meters of robe material, and the monks jump onto the, you know, the sewing machine, and we sew the robe within 2 or 3 hours, or maybe more. But at this place, the actual villagers, what they did was they got the cotton, but it was in cotton thread, so they weaved the actual cloth. So you got all these villagers. I don't know how many, maybe 10, 20, 100, 200, I don't know. And they weave this cloth. And then after they do that, they dye it. And then after they dye it, they sew it. Oh, the monks sew it, but they sew it by hand. So, yeah, it's kind of interesting story. But, yeah, meeting monks who are enlightened, I haven't really met many. And if I did, I probably wouldn't tell you.
Okay, I can't really say much because I'm still very, I'm still very new to this game because I just ordained November last year. But Coming to the monastery as a guest, sir, and staying there, sometimes I have seen monks, sir, that's in their 80s, and from what I heard from other people that are staying there, some say this is a very good monk, so it might have reached some level of enlightenment, but one thing I always notice, they're very happy, very peaceful, and even if they in their 80s, they have a lot of energy. It's almost like looking at a young person, like a young kid. For someone that age, you see a person is very dull and it's like they're almost half dead. But but to see a monk in his 80s, it's like looking at a child really happy. Very peaceful, and always asking questions. What's this? What's that? What's this? What's that? Oh, okay, that's good. Really happy. So that's one thing that really inspired me, to see all these great teachers that come over and stay here, and they're very happy. One of the most happiest people I've ever seen, and even if they're so old, they have a lot of energy. Like the mind has got this energy within that drives the person, and is very inspiring to come across a teacher like that. Yep. So I think that's only story I the only person that I've seen that I think could be most likely is enlightened. Thanks.
Okay, very good. You continue sitting or call it a night and save up your energy for tomorrow. Right.